From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. William Cole took over as head of the Baltimore Development Corporation this month. The BDC is the city's economic development arm. We asked the former city councilman about his ideas to spur growth and whether parts of the city see more investment than others. Then, ahead of his talk at the Baltimore Speaker Series tomorrow, author, actor, science journalist, and professor Alan Alda tells us how his many career paths share a common thread. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews A Midsummer Night's Dream at Chesapeake Shakespeare Company. And Reina Grande grew up in an unstable family in a poor Mexican village. But that's not where her story ends. She talks with Tom Hall about the journey that inspired her latest book. First, today's news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
Thanks, Nathan. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. The Baltimore Development Corporation is the city's economic development arm. It works out deals with real estate developers and tries to lure businesses to the city. In August, the head of the BDC, Brenda McKenzie, resigned after little more than a year and a half on the job. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake appointed Baltimore City Councilman William Cole to take over as the new president and CEO of the BDC, and he joins me now in the studio. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, good morning. Thank you.
So for people not familiar with the BDC, give us the headline version of what it does.
I mean, you just defined it very well. We are the economic development arm of the city of Baltimore. We are not a traditional structured organization in that we're a non-direct city agency. We are quasi. We receive a lot of our funding from the city, but we're outside of city government in that regard. We focus on the city's economic development each and every day, and that's our sole and exclusive purpose.
So what are the areas for growth that you see in Baltimore?
Wow. I mean, we've seen a tremendous amount of residential construction in the last couple of years, apartments, lots of apartments throughout the city. And it's not just targeted in one area. We've seen it along the waterfront. We've seen it in downtown, and now we're seeing it in neighborhoods across the city. Our port is as strong as ever, and people forget to talk about the Port of Baltimore, but it is a huge economic engine for us. We've seen tremendous growth we're the number one roll-on, roll-off importer, and that's the Port of Baltimore. And it's an important story to tell. I mean, we are a port city, and I want to remember that as we move forward. But we've seen tremendous growth, and we're actually, starting to feel like Baltimore's growing again. The numbers are starting to show that people are moving here and staying here, and that's an important part of the story.
So if there's that much momentum, why do we need a BDC?
You still have to have an economic development agency. Every county has one. A lot of the economic development strategy comes from the mayor's office in collaboration with BDC, but BDC is essential in making certain that these projects move forward, and in some cases making certain that projects don't move forward if it's not the right fit for the city or if it's not the right fit for neighborhoods.
Well, as you know, critics of the BDC say that the incentives it has given developers in the past were overly generous.
It's fair criticism when you take a short view, but in the long view, a lot of these projects were critical to Baltimore's revitalization. I don't think that Baltimore would look the way it does right now if Mayor Schaefer didn't take a leap on Harbor Place, for example. And sometimes you have to be bold. And it may not be popular at the time, but in the long view, it's generally in the best interest of the city. I will say that the subsidy portion of BDC is something that is the most scrutinized aspect of it, and we take it very seriously. I mean, we have a very talented group of people at the agency that review each and every deal that comes before us. We have a volunteer board that meets and studies these deals, and they make recommendations. And ultimately, it goes through a full public process once it gets through the BDC process. And not every deal that comes before us is approved. We've just in the last month had to reject two that came before us, and we'll continue to do that if we don't think it's in the city and the taxpayers' best interest.
But give me the rationale if Baltimore is as attractive as you were saying a few minutes ago in terms of the momentum. Well, why are these incentives needed?
There are every county and even the state of Maryland provides incentives, particularly to businesses, to either bring them here or to keep them here. So it's not unique to Baltimore. Every jurisdiction has some form of incentive package. In Baltimore, we tend to get bogged down in the larger ones and say that they're unfair or unjustly rich. But the reality is, without BDC, we wouldn't have a renovated Mondawmin Mall. We wouldn't have a Target at Mondawmin, for example. The Howard's Park ShopRite probably wouldn't exist without BDC and some of the incentives. Belvedere Square wouldn't have been renovated. So these are neighborhood projects that people tend to forget about when talking about BDC. They focus on the big one like Harbor Point, and they say, that's unnecessary. But the reality is, with our property tax rate the way it is, and the fact that we are not competitive right now when it comes to our property tax rate, you do need to provide some level of assistance on some of these more complex projects. We're also seeing projects that don't need any subsidy, and in that case, they move forward without anything at all. And we're starting to see that as well. But some projects, the numbers just don't work without some form of assistance. But in the end, we get that back through increased property tax collection. And that's the part that I think is often lost in the argument.
As you know, one of the biggest criticisms, and you anticipated this in your last answer, the idea that the BDC supports big downtown development at the expense of neighborhoods. We spoke with Jay Brody, who was head of the BDC from 96 to 2012, and he says that's not true. It's a perception problem.
It's not easy to strike a downtown and neighborhood balance. Particularly, the media tends to feature the downtown stuff. The projects are bigger. They photograph more easily.
How do you change that perception?
Well, I think that and Jay nails it, because it is a perception issue. And just in my month at BDC, I have discovered that 75% of the staff time, energy, talent, efforts, and energy is spent on neighborhood issues. It's not on downtown projects, but it is the downtown projects that seem to capture the larger media attention. And I think Jay nails it. It's because it makes for prettier pictures, and that's where they like to run and set up their TV cameras or their send their photographers. But the reality is, much of, if not the overwhelming majority of what we do at BDC is focusing on neighborhood development, Main Street programs, the Small Business Resource Center, Emerging Technology Center. These are all things that come through BDC that aren't focused on downtown, but on growing small business throughout the city and helping stabilize neighborhoods and doing the things that we do each and every day. And we've got a talented staff back at 36 South Charles that's focusing on that as we sit here.
On 88.1 WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Bill Cole, president and CEO of the Baltimore Development Corporation. He's former Baltimore City Councilman. So let's talk about you at the BDC, because your councilmanic district was downtown. You're a big supporter of a big event like the Grand Prix. Mm-hmm. For Baltimoreans who live in neighborhoods, what should they expect from you?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, having served in the House of Delegates, I represented a lot of very diverse neighborhoods throughout South and Southwest Baltimore. And then on the City Council, I've had two different districts, because I went through redistricting, and my district shifted from a district that includes Central Baltimore and all the way up through Reservoir Hill to a district that stopped at North Avenue in the north and went all the way to the Hanover Street in the south. So I've had the privilege and honor of representing tons of neighborhoods. And one of the things that's always frustrating, particularly when you look at the growth of Baltimore, the fastest growing census tract is downtown. And I think it's important to note that downtown Baltimore is now a neighborhood, too. It's not just a commercial district. There is a very vibrant and growing downtown residential population. We're one of the, I think it's top 15 now in the country. I want to say we're in top 10, but I don't want to misstate it. We have a growing and large residential downtown population that should be identified as a neighborhood. But in addition to that, I've represented very wonderful neighborhoods in West Baltimore and North Baltimore, north being north of North Avenue, and certainly understand that there is no one-size-fits-all approach to Baltimore City. Every neighborhood is unique, and while there are many commonalities, the reality is each neighborhood has different needs and expectations. And I don't think you can create some cookie-cutter economic development approach and one-size-fits-all attitude about it. And I think you have to sit down and listen. And I've started my very first week on the job. I met with the Main Street managers and I've done one Main Street tour, and we'll be doing the rest of the Main Street districts throughout the month of October walking it with the businesses that are on those Main Street corridors to figure out what BDC can do to help ensure that they remain vibrant or help find ways to attract new businesses, because that's what stabilized neighborhoods. You want to be able to have the types of goods and services in neighborhoods so that people don't have to leave.
Let's broaden it out a little bit. We spoke with Mel Freeman over at the Citizens Planning and Housing Association, a nonprofit that works on neighborhood issues. He told us he's optimistic about your being the chair. But one of the things he wanted to know is how the BDC can strengthen local business.
Well, one of the things that clearly the Main Street program is one, and that is ensuring that we're putting whatever resources that we have available into strengthening those small businesses. And sometimes it's just facade improvements. Sometimes it's making them look a bit more appealing so that you draw more foot traffic. In other cases, it's working with them to put up banners so that you know you have a destination. I think a lot of it depends on what the community needs, and that's why it's hard to say there's one set answer. You have to know what each community needs. I remember the very first time I ever walked on Pennsylvania Avenue, and I was representing that on the city council, a woman said to me, "It's a shame that every service I need, I have to go to another neighborhood to get." And those are the types of conversations we need to be having and figuring out how we could support, say, a dry cleaners in a neighborhood where people need a dry cleaners and don't want to have to take their clothes to their workplace to have them clean. I mean, those are small things, but they're big issues when you live in a neighborhood that doesn't have, you know, a grocery store or a dry cleaner.
We're almost out of time, and I do have to ask you, your predecessor, Brenda McKenzie, was working on a comprehensive economic development strategy. What does that stand?
I picked it up from Brenda. She had done some good work on that, and we hope to have a product by the end of this year.
By the end of this year.
Yes, ma'am.
I've got more questions, but we're out of time. So we'll ask you back. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Sheila. Appreciate it.
Bill Cole, President and CEO of the Baltimore Development Corporation. Before that, he was a Baltimore City Councilman and a member of the state legislature. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. Just ahead, Alan Alda. Stay with us on 88.1.
Producer Jamila Kay. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. For some, Alan Alda will always be Hawkeye Pierce, the sarcastic but tender-hearted surgeon bedeviling U.S. Army superiors during the Korean War. The final episode of season 11 of MASH in 1983, which Alda directed as well as starred in, was the most watched television broadcast ever until the 2010 Super Bowl. But Alda's career has been packed in the last three decades. Movies, as a writer and director, as well as an actor. More television, including a role in the last 2 years of The West Wing as Republican Senator Arnold Vinnick, for which Alda won another Emmy. In 1993, Alda started a new calling as a science journalist when he signed on to host the PBS series Scientific American Frontiers. He's written two autobiographical books, and tomorrow he'll be in Baltimore to kick off the new season of the Baltimore Speaker Series presented by Stevenson University. And Alan Alda joins us on the line from New York. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Now, you have immersed yourself in science in the last two decades, several PBS series, other projects. What's the big appeal to you of science?
You know, I just love it. It's fun to me. It's amazing to me to read and to talk to read about and talk to scientists about their work, because I just can't get over the fact that they can figure out such abstruse things based on such a little bit of evidence, but it's reliable, and they can prove that they got it right. And just watching their minds work is one of the most fascinating things, I think, that you can see in the world. It's a part of nature that just amazes me.
I read that you started reading the articles in Scientific American in your early 20s. Now, this would have been a time when you were getting a very vibrant comedy and acting career going. Why were you reading Scientific American?
Because it fascinated me, because it was a foreign language that I was trying to learn, just trying to pick up what the words meant and what the concepts were on the fly. And it was really a lot like learning another language, and the languages have always interested me. I've always tried to learn a language at least enough to be able to make somebody laugh in that language.
Wow, humor is hard in another language.
Yeah, but if you speak languages the way I do, they start laughing pretty quickly.
I've heard you make a distinction between interviews and what you do when you're talking to scientists, which you call conversations.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
I think we found something kind of unusual in presenting science, an unusual way to do it. We just stumbled into it. And it was that we had a pure conversation, the scientists and I. It wasn't a case of me going in with a list of questions. I didn't know what I was going to ask them, and I didn't know what they were going to say to me. I was just trying to understand. And that had a completely different effect on the scientists than if they saw me asking formal questions that they had to come up with formal answers to. They saw that if I didn't understand them, I just kept badgering them until I did. So they started to forget about the camera and forget about an audience listening on the other side of the camera, and they were just talking to me personally and trying to get me to get it. And that kind of shift to a more personal tone, I think, made it more accessible to the audience as well. And it kind of led to my understanding that you could probably train scientists to achieve that personal tone and that contact with the audience.
And I wanted to ask you about that. At Stony Brook University in New York, you created the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science. What's that about?
Well, it's an attempt to train scientists while they're learning to be scientists to learn the skills of communication. And we do kind of unusual things to help them achieve that. One of them is we teach them improvisation games and exercises, which are designed to bring you in contact with the other person. And it really has an amazing effect. We've done this. We are spreading this around the country, and other universities are partnering with us. And we did it in a couple of universities with very senior scientists who are already good communicators. And they were our most enthusiastic partners because they realize how hard it is to communicate with people who don't have your training. And you have to somehow translate. You have to speak the same language and know what they're thinking while they're listening to you. That's one of the difficult things you have to learn. But what's interesting about the things that I'll be talking about tomorrow night, but this is making me think of that, is that tomorrow night is really about my life in a way that I tried to understand my life, which in a way led to all these things you and I are talking about now, which is, in a way, I'm trying to teach the scientists to really be there. And one of the things I was trying to learn in my life was how I could really be there. I had a strange life. I started out standing in the wings watching burlesque when I was 2 years old.
Because your father was an actor.
Yeah. It was a very odd beginning, but I was drawn to the comics and I was drawn to the chorus girls. They were very sweet to me. They were like motherly to me. So I had a lot of these early moments in my life, as odd as they were, in a strange way built up to the things I do now and in a way to the contribution I think I can make now.
Well, I get that all of our experiences play into who we are and what we can do and what we can contribute. But your contribution seems so wide. This whole science thing we've been talking about seems to me a different track than, for example, you're going back to Broadway this fall.
I'm going to do
Candace Bergen, revival of the comedy Love Letters.
Right, it's a lovely play. I love Love Letters because it's not sentimental in my opinion. It's very tough, And it's about, it's about the same thing we've been talking about, only it's not about a scientist and a non-scientist trying to communicate. It's about two people who actually love each other trying to communicate. And that's one of the things that one of these great scientists who took our workshop said after the workshop, this has helped me communicate better in every way, including with my wife. So in a way, what we do in any part of our lives, whether it's a boss and an employee, a husband and a wife, lovers, scientists, and the rest of us, we're all trying to help each other understand one another. And I guess that's a lot of what, for some reason, that's a lot of what my life has been about.
So when I look at this range of activities, from science to writing to Broadway, I should not think attention deficit disorder. I should think there's a connection in all this.
I don't know. Maybe I just, it's lucky I called you. Maybe I got a diagnosis.
That is not my job. But it sounds like it's going
to
be.
No, I'm just, you know what, I'm curious, and I like to be active. It makes me feel alive, and I like to do things that scare me. I'll be talking about some of the things I've done that scared me. I get scared into knowing I'm there by some of the things I do, and I don't scare myself by hanging off mountains or bungee jumping the way normal people do. I don't like to go into the wilderness unless the wilderness has a lobby, but I scare myself sometimes by going and speaking at places where I'm not. I really have no business being, and I have to quickly get up to speed and find out why I'm there.
Well, it sounds like tomorrow's going to be a fascinating evening. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.
Writer, actor, professor Alan Alda. Tomorrow night at the Meyerhoff, he'll kick off the 2014-2015 season of the Baltimore Speaker Series, presented by Stevenson University. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. More ahead on Maryland Morning. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up, a conversation with the author of this year's One Maryland One book selection. Reina Grande will join me in a few minutes to talk about her memoir, The Distance Between Us. But first, the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company has moved from its Ellicott City base to a beautiful new theater in downtown Baltimore. Their first production in their new digs is Shakespeare's classic comedy, A Midsummer Night's Dream. Maryland Morning theater critic Jay Wynn Russick has been to see it, and here's her review.
Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream is a play about transformations. That makes it an ideal inaugural production for the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company, which has undergone a major transformation of its own. The 12-year-old company has moved from Howard County to Baltimore and into its first permanent indoor space. That space itself is a place of transformation. Built in 1885 as Mercantile Safe Deposit and Trust, the building on the corner of Calvert and Redwood has had many lives, most recently as a nightclub. Chesapeake Shakespeare neatly retrofitted the ornate interior with a three-tiered 260-seat theater inspired by Shakespeare's Globe. Its production of A Midsummer Night's Dream makes actors and audience feel right at home in this glorious space. Actors move among the theatergoers. Live music by songwriters ranging from Henry Mancini to Screamin' Jay Hawkins punctuates the play. Puck, the sprite who does the Fairy King's bidding, practically soars around the theater's various levels. And the tradesmen who perform the comical play within the play at the wedding of the Duke of Athens are working at the Duke's palace. They do repairs, move furniture, at one point, clean up spilled champagne. You can almost picture these Shakespearean workmen putting the finishing touches on this very building, then stepping on stage to play their parts. Shakespeare's play, of course, is about love among three distinct groups of lovers. There are the royals, represented by the Duke of Athens and his bride, the Queen of the Amazons. There are the monarchs of the fairy kingdom, Oberon and Titania. And there are two pairs of young lovers so interchangeable, even they have difficulty sorting out whom they love. Even so, Audrey Berthaud distinguishes herself as Helena, bringing a Carol Burnett-like sensibility to this much-put-upon character. The rude mechanicals, or workmen, make up a fourth stratum of society. Under Ian Gallinar's direction, the actors who play these well-meaning bumblers deliver some of the production's best, most consistent work. Gregory Burgess leads this intrepid pack as stage-struck Bottom the Weaver, a blowhard Burgess makes endearing. Bottom is the sad soul transmogrified by Puck. The poor weaver has no idea that Puck has given him a donkey's head, terrifying his cronies and bewitching Titania into falling in love with him.
I see their knavery. This is to make an ass of me, to frighten me if they could. But I will not stir from this place, do what they can. I will walk around here, and I will sing, that they shall know that I am not afraid.
Lauren Engler's Titania and David Mavrikos' Oberon aren't especially commanding figures, although Titania's band of fairies is a tough, earthy lot. A few actors overdo their performances, perhaps because they're more accustomed to performing outdoors at Chesapeake Shakespeare's summer venue. The standout performance is Vince Isenson's portrayal of Puck, who stirs up most of the play's mischief. When he isn't moving at warp speed, this Puck has a delightful knack for putting a slow motion or even stop action spell on the other characters. And he brings an amusing country-western twang to his delivery.
When thou wakest, thou takest true delight in the sight of thy former lady's eye, and the country proverb known, that every man should take his own, in your waking shall be shown, Jack shall have Jill, not shall go ill, the man shall have his mare again, and all shall be well.
Designer Christina Lambden's costumes have clever touches, especially those worn by the workmen in the play within the play. Bottom's crucial donkey mask, a full-head rubber mask, is a poor choice, however, muffling some of the actor's words. This is Chesapeake Shakespeare and artistic director Ian Gallinar's third Midsummer Night's Dream. It may be the perfect outdoor play, but it shows the company's new indoor theater off to advantage. Welcome to Baltimore, Chesapeake Shakespeare.
Maryland Morning Theater critic J. Wynn Russick. A Midsummer Night's Dream is at the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company until October 12th. Come to our website, wypr.org, for more information. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Every year, the Maryland Humanities Council chooses a book which we're all encouraged to read and to discuss at events that the Council organizes around the state. It's kind of like a statewide book club. Well, this year, they've chosen a memoir by Reina Grande. Her novels have won the American Book Award, the El Premio Aztlán Literary Award, the International Latino Book Award, and in 2012, she was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. Her memoir tells the story of her childhood in a poor Mexican town and the difficulties that she and her siblings endured as her fractured family forged a new life in the United States. Her story is heartbreaking at times, and it offers a trenchant insight into the immigrant experience and the experience of families everywhere as they try to heal the wounds caused by the problems of divorce, abuse, and dislocation. The book is called The Distance Between Us. Reina Grande will be appearing throughout the area this week in several events to discuss her book, and this morning she joins me in the studio. It's great to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Thanks for coming. Tell us about Iguala, the town in which you grew up as a child in Mexico.
Iguala is a city in the state of Guerrero. Most people probably haven't heard of Guerrero, but Acapulco is a city in Guerrero. And Iguala is about 3 hours east of Acapulco. So we're inland, surrounded by mountains. When I lived there, Iguala was very small, and it's still small. It's 100,000 people who live there. But to me, it was always very, a very rural place, even though it was a small city, because my family lived in the outskirts, in the developing areas of the city.
What do folks do for a living there, by and large?
Iguala, it's a very poor state, and Guerrero is the second poorest state in Mexico. So, you know, there are not a lot of opportunities in terms of work, and I think that's why a lot of people migrate from the area.
Including your family.
Including my family. There's not many opportunities. There's a large factory there that's owned by a U.S. corporation. It's a clothing factory, and I've had cousins who have worked there, but they make $50 a week, which is not a whole lot. And that's, I would say, one of the largest employers in Iguala. I think they employed like 500 people or so. There used to be a train station there. There was a train that would come by, and at the train station, a lot of people would actually find jobs there. My sister, when she was 12, she used to work at the train station selling food at a food stand. And my uncles used to work at the train station loading and unloading the freight cars that would come by. But then when the government privatized the railroads, that train was suspended. And it really caused a lot more people to go deeper into poverty, because then they all lost their jobs.
And your dad left the family to come to the United States when you were just 2 years old, mm-hmm. For that reason, right? It was difficult for him to find work in Iguala. Right?
Yes, my father was a bricklayer, so he worked in construction. And, you know, even before he decided to come out here, he was already leaving our house. He would go to Mexico City. He would go to Acapulco or to Sinaloa to look for work. So he was already leaving our house because there was nothing there in Iguala for him. And eventually he decided to go farther north and come to the U.S.
You're the middle of three children. Tell us about your older sister, Mago, and your younger brother, Carlos.
Well, my older sister, Mago, she's my hero, and I think she's the hero in the memoir as well, because when my parents came to the U.S., she became the mother, and she gave up her childhood to take care of me and my brother, and she was a really wonderful person in my life. She was very strong, and she always tried to make me feel better about our situation, and she tried to keep our hope up that my parents would come back one day, and she was there to take care of me.
So your father leaves when you were two.
Mm-hmm.
Your mom, your father calls for your mom to join him in the United States, but without you and your sister and your brother,
mm-hmm.
When you were, what, about four
years
old?
I was four and a half.
Yeah. And who did you live with when they both left to come to the United States?
We lived with my father's mother, whom I often call my evil grandmother, because her name spelled like the word evil with an A, and because she was very mean. We lived with her because my father wanted us to stay with his mom. And I think for me that made my parents' absence so much harder, because we were left in a household where my relatives did not want us there, and we were made to feel that we were a burden to them. And they did not treat us very well.
The lure of what you referred to as el otro lado, the other side, the United States, did you share that passion and desire to come to the U.S. knowing that your mother and father were in the U.S.? Were you waiting, on pins and needles for the call to come to say, you know, now you can come join us?
I don't think I was desperate to come here. I was desperate for them to come back to me. And so, you know, I wanted my parents to come back to Mexico, because that was my home, and I wanted my parents back in my life. So I didn't think too much about coming here, because I just wanted them to come back home. Yeah.
One of the things that strikes me, and of course, you know, the issue of immigration, undocumented people coming across the border is, of course, very much in the news, very much in part of the political dialogue in the United States now, is the relative ease and fluidity of movement between the U.S. and Mexico. Your father and mother both came back and forth several times as undocumented people. Was this something that was just sort of accepted, fairly easy to do when you were growing up, or were other people in the town doing it as well?
Yeah, it was actually many years before my border crossing, it was more fluid. You know, migrants can come and go, and they had no problem, especially like during the Bracero movement. A lot of people would always come back, and it was seasonal. Coming to the U.S. was seasonal. You know, they'll come, work here for a few months, and then go home. And that's the way it was. You know, they would always come home and then leave again. By the time my father immigrated, things were getting a little harder. Not as hard as they are today, but they were getting a little harder. And when I did the border crossing, we snuck across Tijuana, you know, the Tijuana border. And now you can't do that because there's a big wall there. And a lot of people are now, that's why they're trying through the desert because of the wall. When I crossed, there was no wall, but we still got caught 2 times by Border Patrol. So it wasn't that easy. And, you know, we on our second crossing, we found a dead man hidden under the bushes. So there was some danger involved. But I think now with the border enforcement being what it is and the border has been militarized, the parents here are basically stuck and they can't go home the way my father went home to get us. They can't go home, which has now created families to be separated for much longer than before. And then parents, because they can't go back, they're forced to send for their children. So what we're seeing now is children coming on their own to cross the border to try to be reunited with their parents. And I didn't have to do that. I didn't have to cross alone. My father was able to come back for me and make the journey across the border with me. So even though it was, you know, dangerous, I had my father by my side. And the kids nowadays, they don't have that, you know, that they're going at it on their own, which I just think it's really heartbreaking to think of these little kids trying to cross the border by themselves.
Yeah, and, it's unimaginable and what they go through as little children. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for us here, like we don't even let our kids cross the street by themselves. And then you have thousands of immigrant children who are putting their lives in danger just because they want to have a family the way I did when I crossed the border.
Reina Grande, the book is called The Distance Between Us. It's the Maryland, the One Maryland One book selection this year from the Maryland Humanities Council on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. You have an acute memory of these events from your childhood, and you have essentially, by the end of the book, you know, you tell us about how you've basically been abandoned by your father. You've been abandoned by your mother, who has taken up with someone else. She's even had a baby with another person. You really are on your own, but you make it through college. You become a writer. You've gotten yourself firmly established here in the United States. These memories that you have from your childhood strike me as incredibly vivid. I mean, you're remembering everything. There's a lot of kids going through the you know, the abuse that you and your siblings endured, the abandonment, the harsh treatment by your grandmother and your grandparents. A lot of kids suppress that kind of thing, mm-hmm. but it doesn't seem to be suppressed at all in your mind.
No, I think for me, I always wanted to remember, because I felt that it was important for me to always remember where I came from. And when I started writing at 13, I always wrote about my experiences in Mexico and here in the U.S. I always wrote them down because I didn't want to forget. And I think writing, the act of writing, has really helped me to heal. And I felt that I had to write those things down, because if I suppressed them, you know, they were just going to make me a very bitter person to hold it all in. And I didn't want that to happen to me. So I decided to just, you know, write them down and to be honest with all the feelings that I had, and use the writing as a way to help me to come to a place of understanding.
Well, it's a book, I'm sure. You obviously haven't forgotten what happened, and when folks read this book, they're not going to forget this book either. It's really quite powerful. So thanks so much for your time, and thanks for the book.
Thank you.
Brenda Grande, she's the author of The Distance Between Us, which has been chosen as this year's One Maryland, One Book selection. Tonight, Ms. Grande will be at the Carroll County Arts Center in Westminster. She'll be in Salisbury tomorrow night at Warwick Community College, and on Wednesday morning, she'll be at the Germantown campus of Montgomery College, and she'll speak at the Waldorf West Branch Library on Wednesday night. We've got a link to details about all of the One Maryland, One Book events that'll take place not only this week, but throughout the year. Come to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. And this program, note, be sure to tune in to WYPR Thursday afternoons at 5:45 for the Humanities Connection, hosted by the Executive Director of the Maryland Humanities Council, Phoebe Stein. Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. The show is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. We've got production help from Payam Agagasam and Elizabeth Sherwood. For more about what you've heard on our show or to catch something you've missed, come on over to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Wednesday morning here on the program, a conversation about a novel set in Baltimore in which the lines between racial and ethnic identity are blurred surgically. For Sheila Cast, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening.